KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. It looks like Seattle Central Community College will move into part of Beacon Hill's old PacMed building. We're going to have details about that just ahead. But first, the big news. The Egyptian military declared a state of emergency earlier today after reports that scores of people had been killed by security forces in the streets. They conducted a widespread sweep to clear supporters of deposed President Mohamed Morsi from their encampments. We also heard interim Vice President Mohamed Al-Baradei put in his resignation today. I caught up earlier this morning, about 20 minutes ago, with Kristen Chick. She's Cairo correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and I asked her to explain exactly what had sparked the violence.
I would say the security forces attacked the pro-Morsi protest camps this morning. The operation was launched fairly early this morning, and there's two main camps where supporters of Morsi had been camped for over a month. And the police, with the military standing by, sent in bulldozers, fired tear gas, and used live gunfire to disperse the protests. And they successfully dispersed the smaller of the two camps. But at the larger camp, there are still clashes going on. There are still people trapped inside, still gunfire, still a very bad situation.
The government itself says they didn't do any live fire, that they only shot tear gas canisters in, but there's no way that the tear gas would have killed anybody. So who was doing the firing exactly?
It appears that the police is doing the firing. I can tell you from all of the bodies I saw that were killed by gunshot wounds to the chest and the head that the police certainly appear to be using a lot more than tear gas canisters.
How many people were killed? Do you have any kind of accurate estimates at this point?
At this point, the health ministry has said that 149 people were killed. I think that number is going to rise drastically still. The Muslim Brotherhood has said that something like 2,000 people were killed, which I think is a wildly inaccurate number. But the government has been releasing also very inaccurate numbers on the lower side. And one of the reasons it's hard to get an accurate number of the people killed today is because those clashes are still going on in the larger protest camp. And there's actually field hospitals with bodies piled up on the floor, and those bodies haven't been able to get out to the health ministry yet. So there's not actually an accurate count, but I think it will be in the hundreds when all is said and done.
Now, you're in Cairo, but as we understand it, there are other parts of Egypt that are also seeing the same kind of violence today.
Right. After the police attacked the two camps this morning, we've seen sort of a wave of violence wash over Egypt. There have been attacks on police stations and government buildings, and in a really worrying development, there have been dozens of churches attacked, and most of those have been in southern Egypt, where the Christian population is highest. And we've seen many churches torched. We've seen Coptic Christian homes and businesses attacked. And that violence is still going on as well.
And this is supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood attacking those churches?
This is what the local priests are saying. I cannot verify that myself. But, after Morsi was deposed, we saw the same thing happen where angry Islamists attacked Christians, and this is largely a result of the sectarian rhetoric that the Muslim Brotherhood itself has engaged in over the past few months. They have blamed Christians for fomenting the rebellion against Morsi. They've accused Christians of stabbing Egypt in the back and making up the bulk of the protests against Morsi. And that kind of rhetoric, I think, has caused their grassroots supporters to become very angry, and they're blaming Christians for what has happened. And apparently, according to the priests at the churches that have been attacked, they're taking out that anger by torching churches and attacking Coptic shops. Now, I'm not there to see it for myself, but this is what those priests say.
Is there any truth to the accusations that Christians are behind the anti-Muslim Brotherhood move?
No, there's not. Christians were, by and large, were not supporting Morsi simply because, you know, he came from an organization that they rightfully distrusted. It had used Morsi and his organization, the used sectarian rhetoric during the presidential election, and Christians, by and large, did not trust him. And I would say that probably the majority of them supported the protests against Morsi. But to say that Christians, you know, were behind the protests and were the reason behind his ouster is ridiculous. That it was, you know, something that that Morsi supporters use, I think, to have a place to funnel their anger.
Now, lastly, the Egyptian military has declared a 30-day state of emergency. What does that mean?
The state of emergency gives the police and the military more leeway to arrest people and to restrict movement. So they've also declared a curfew from 7 p.m. until 6 a.m., and, you know, the state of emergency is actually something that that was railed against during the original protests in January 2011. The president, Mubarak, had kept the state of emergency in Egypt for most of his 30-year rule. And you know, it was really the cover for a lot of police abuse. And people were fed up with it. And now here we are once again with the state of emergency.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that this is similar to what happened under Mubarak, because I've heard some commentators say that the violence that we're seeing now is far worse than what had happened most recently under Mubarak, that you know, hundreds of people dead in the streets is something that has not happened in Egypt in many, many years.
Well, we did, you know, there were over 800 people killed during the uprising against Mubarak, and we still have, you know, to see what the death toll is going to be a year from today. But, you know, during the uprising against Mubarak, most of the deaths occurred on January 28th, and today, I think the death toll today is going to be very high, but it also looks like the violence is going to continue for the next days, maybe even weeks. You know, it doesn't look like it's going to end today, so that's very worrying.
What have you heard from people that I guess I think of as in the center someplace, just average citizens?
You know, I would say maybe a majority of Cairenes are cheering the military and the police on as they crack down against Morsi supporters. Morsi alienated, I would say, most Egyptians besides his most loyal supporters during his rule. And we saw these massive protests against him before the military responded to the protests and ousted him. And since then, in the months that his supporters have been camped out, or maybe it's a month and a half now that his supporters have been camped out, the public sentiment has been growing against them. People are fed up. People have actually been urging the police and the government to break up the protests, to crack down on them. And today, as I was out near the protests, there were local residents who were watching what was going on, and they were cheering the police. They were literally asking the police to kill everyone in the square.
That's a horrifying thought to see that. So as a reporter, you're anticipating a higher death toll, increased violence. What can come out of all this for Egypt?
Well, it looks like a long road ahead. I think that the plans that the military-backed government had for a fairly quick transition that your elected leaders are derailed. I don't see how they can hold elections and, you know, continue on with amending the Constitution and doing these kinds of things in this kind of context. I think, you know, they're sure to face a lot of international criticism. And I don't think that the leaders have figured out what their end game is and where they're going from here. They've really, you know, unleashed a dangerous situation for Egypt with this crackdown, and I don't think they know how they're going to resolve it.
Christian Chick is Cairo correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Earlier today, the Egyptian military declared a state of emergency after security forces conducted a widespread sweep to try to clear supporters of deposed President Mohamed Morsi from their encampments. Hundreds of people have been killed. The death toll is still rising. And we heard reports about 10 minutes ago that interim Vice President Mohamed Al-Baradei announced his resignation in the wake of that violence. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
It's 918 KUOW 94.9, news and information.
Support for KUOW comes from the merchants at SeaTac Airport, including Freshens on Concourse C, featuring made-to-order fruit smoothies and frozen yogurt for travel. Information on SeaTac Merchants Mileage Plan participation at SeaTacShops.com.
In Seattle, 69 degrees, currently expecting a high today in the mid-70s with partly sunny skies. A low tonight around 60, mostly cloudy. A 40% chance of rain tonight in the Seattle area. And Thursday's high again in the mid-70s, mostly cloudy with a 30% chance of showers on Thursday.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. It looks like Seattle Central Community College is going to be moving into part of the space of the old PacMed building on Beacon Hill. The Public Development Authority that oversees the Art Deco building voted last night to accept a tentative deal with the state of Washington to rent 13 floors in the building over a 30-year period. Rosemary Aragon is executive director of the Pacific Hospital Preservation and Development Authority. She joins me now. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Can you explain the terms of the agreement with the state?
Yes. Why don't I start by explaining what the vote was last night?
Sure.
So what happened was our governing council of this public development authority signed a letter of intent with the state of Washington Department of Commerce in which the Department of Commerce has 90 days to do the kind of due diligence they really want to do, looking at the building, building condition, possible tenants, and the like. At the end of that 90 days or before, we have an agreed-upon lease document. And assuming this 90-day period doesn't bring out anything that would be surprising to us, they will sign the lease. So let's assume that will all happen because this really is a really well-conditioned building with much improvement having been done in it over the years. So I'm going to assume that's all going to go well. Assuming the lease is signed in November, then it will be effective January 1. It's a 30-year lease for the whole building, and the intent of the Department of Commerce and the state is that approximately 6 floors of it will be used by the Seattle Community College District, predominantly Central Community College, for their Allied Health Professionals program.
Who's going to move into the rest of the space?
A number of not-for-profit organizations have indicated their interest in moving in and benefiting from co-location. So just a couple of those that have said they are interested include NeighborCare, one of our wonderful community health centers here in Seattle, King County, and 501 Commons.
So essentially a coalition of nonprofits. Mm-hmm. You had another not nonprofit or for-profit option that was another possible choice, which was to convert part of this building into market rate apartments. What ultimately tipped the balance for you in favor of the state?
The Pacific Hospital PDA's mission is about improving access to health care and health resources and to remove barriers, especially those that exist for persons of color. Knowing that this program would be training allied health professionals, nurses, medical assistants, and the like, we felt that one of the elements of improving access is to have more of these allied health professionals available to assist in care. And that was important to us.
How does what your prime mission as a sort of looking at healthcare and serving the community, how does that fit into what the neighborhood envisions for the area around the old PacMed building?
First of all, can we call it the Pacific Tower?
We can.
Let's do that because patients, the Pacific Medical Center's clinic, formerly known as PacMed Clinics, is one of our tenants. And it's been confusing to their patients to read articles that talk about something happening to PacMed. So it worries them. They think something's going to happen to their patient care and their clinic, and it's not.
Okay.
Yeah. So
Pacific Tower.
Pacific
okay.
Tower.
How do your plans for the Pacific Tower fit into what the neighborhood envisions for the area around that old Art Deco building?
Well, it's been amazing. I've been here for 10 years, and to watch what's been going on with the I'm just going to talk now about parks. The Lewis Park on the east of us, which is a natural park, and the wonderful work done in Jose Rizal on the west side of us. A lot of work's been done to make it the kind of a neighborhood where people want to be outside, want to be in parks, want to be safe. And I've tried to keep a close relationship with the neighbors because we're a neighbor too. And I think what they see with this option is an educational institution closer to them, more opportunity possibly for people that live here to take classes at the community college. They see people on the streets that would be active and about and shopping. And it just brings a positive vitality that really would be wonderful up here on Beacon Hill.
You mentioned you've been with the PDA for 10 years.
Yes.
I know that a lot of the Pacific Tower has been empty since October. That's a long time. Has the vacancy lasted that long because you as a PDA were trying to figure out the best way forward, or was there another reason?
Well, we have been leasing the building since October of 2012. And that actually, this is kind of a short time period
okay.
for leasing a building of this size and uniqueness. So we consider this to be actually fast. Now, what it has meant for us is we've had to defer our grant making during this time period, but you do what you have to do.
Are there any particular challenges when you are trying to figure out the future of a building that has architectural importance and historic significance?
We have requirements from Landmarks Preservation in the city of Seattle that are well known, but they really relate to the exterior of the building. Other than the really beautiful Art Deco entrance and lobby on the south entrance. But inside, it's essentially an office building with quite updated IT, mechanical, and other systems that were put in place by Wright Runstad for their tenant, Amazon. But it's the exterior that is historic.
Not the interior.
Not the interior, with the exception of the Art Deco entrance.
So there's now a 30-day letter of agreement, and you expect, hope at least, and expect that all the steps of due diligence will go smoothly. When would tenants actually begin to move in to the building?
It's a 90-day due diligence.
90-day.
And I believe the plans I saw were fall of 2014.
So approximately 1 year from now, the 13 empty floors will be filled.
Well, the community college would go in first, I believe.
Okay.
I mean, it makes sense for that to happen early.
Probably when school starts.
Yep, that's what I'm thinking.
And I hope that it all goes smoothly for you, Rosemary. Thank you for taking time to talk to us.
You are sure welcome. Thank you.
Rosemary Aragon is Executive Director of the Pacific Hospital Preservation and Development Authority. The PDA voted last night to accept a tentative agreement with the State of Washington Department of Commerce to rent 13 floors in the old Art Deco building on Beacon Hill. This is Weekday. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman, and I'm joined now with our lead producer, Katie Sewell, and Jeannie Yandel, whose voice you know from many, many places, reporter, interviewer, host. And Jeannie, we invited you in here because you have a new job and a new role at KUOW. And Katie and I have been talking about big changes in store for the station coming up in the fall. And you're kind of our circus ringleader.
Yes, executive producer, Jeannie Yandel.
Yes, I'm the executive producer for the new show that's starting on September 3rd, The Record. As a circus ringleader, I apologize for not wearing my top hat or my tails today.
You are wearing them. Our listeners have no
idea.
Right.
The magic of radio.
Yep.
Top hat, tails.
Crack.
That's right.
There's
I have a lion with me.
Great bow tie.
But yeah, I'm the executive producer of The Record, and the most exciting part about it is talking with everybody else who's on the team about what this new venture is going to sound like, what the new show is going to sound like.
And we asked you in here to explain to listeners, because Katie and I have been talking about the change and merging two staffs, and people then ask, well, what am I going to hear? So, Jeannie, what are listeners going to hear when they turn on their radio September 3rd at 12 noon?
Well, the goal is to have a mix, a fresh, interesting mix of local news and culture, which I think KUOW excels at covering. We do. As a listener, I feel proud that this is my public radio station when I hear what we're doing with local news, local issues, local culture. So that's a big part of what you'll hear on The Record. You'll also hear smart coverage of national news and issues and international news and issues. We live in a pretty global city, and so Seattle has ties to things that are happening all over the world. We have a relationship with China that many other cities don't have. We've got all kinds of connections to what's happening elsewhere in the country. Us in Colorado are creating this grand experiment, legalizing marijuana.
Yep.
So we'll be able to bring this kind of news and this kind of coverage and analysis to The Record with the great staff of producers we've got, with you, with Ross Reynolds, with Steve Scher. And my goal here is to have 2 hours of radio that is accessible, that's fun, and that makes you feel, as a listener, part of what's happening in your community and around the world, and that makes you feel smarter at the end of it without being talked down to. I think that's the best thing that public radio does. It always makes me feel smarter without feeling as though I was somehow left out because I wasn't bright enough to begin with to get what was happening.
No, you'd have to leave me out as well if that was the case. So you've got this cast of characters. You mentioned me and Ross Reynolds and Steve Scher, but we also have a crew of producers who are working very hard. And Katie has been the lead producer for Weekday for 9 years now.
Yeah.
But you will not be among this group.
No, I know. And it's not because I'm like, I refuse to join this new venture. No, my husband got an opportunity to study in Rome. And after talking it over, and, you know, believe it or not, I was a little bit sad to leave here. And I do think it's a big risk to just plunge off the cliff and see what happens. But we decided that we're going to go for the academic year next year. And so I will be stepping away from KOW for now, at least.
For now.
Who knows what the future holds. But I'll be over in Rome. And if anybody wants to keep in touch with me, you know, don't leave me isolated on the other side of the world. You can reach me at radiokatie@gmail.com.
That's K-A-T-Y. Now, Jeannie, as Katie describes Rome, this hardship post that she's going to have, I'm thinking, you know, since you talked about smart coverage of international news, like field trips are in order, don't you think?
I would agree. We've talked a lot about getting out in the field for the record.
Feel free to come to Rome.
Yeah, I'm not clear on what the budget is for this, but I think it's certainly worth exploring. And I've said many times I'm very unhappy you're not going to be part of the record, and I plan on squeezing your brains for all the knowledge I can get before you leave. But if that means that, you know, we get to contact you in Rome and perhaps have some field visits in Rome,
yeah,
so much the better.
Or at least virtual visits. And Katie, sending us some material for Rome would be most welcome.
Oh, definitely.
Happy to do it. I'm going to be doing all sorts of radio experimenting while I have the time. So
we always say, as they say in Italy, arrivederci, till we see each other again. It's a ciao. It's not goodbye forever. Just to let you know, listeners, so that means that Weekday, as you know it, we'll have sort of a big, grand 2-week farewell. We've been on the air for 20 years. We have 2 weeks of the best of planned for you starting on Monday the 19th. And then Tuesday, the 3rd of September, which is the day after Labor Day, everybody has a nice 3-day weekend. We start fresh. Your kids are going to school. You've got the new backpack and pencil case. You can just think of the record sort of like that, a shiny new thing that you look at and open with glee. It's going to start at 12 noon, and we hope you're there with us.
Yes.
So thanks, Jeannie Yandel,
new
executive producer. And it's never goodbye for long, Katie Sewell.
No, I'm everywhere.
I'm Marcy Silman, and for now, this is Weekday.
KUOW 94.9. Have you got questions about the rules of the road? Former Seattle traffic cop John Abraham answers your questions today in the noon hour. You can get your question in now by calling the feedback line, 206-221-3663. That's 206-221-3663.
I'm Bill Moyers. This week on Moyers & Company, Taming Capitalism Run Wild. Economist Richard Wolff shines light on the disaster of the financial collapse and how we can now battle for economic democracy. And activist Saru Jayaraman talks about restaurant workers fighting for a living wage. I hope you'll join us.
That's tonight at 10 p.m. on KUOW 94.9.
Support for KUOW comes from the Everett Clinic, offering a wide range of minimally invasive, high-tech surgical techniques, including laparoscopy, surgical robotics, and image-guided surgery. More at everettclinic.com/tech.
In Seattle's University District, 69 degrees right now. Today's expected high in the mid-70s, partly sunny skies, and tonight a low around 60, mostly cloudy, with a 40% chance of rain.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Peter Kariva is shaking things up. He's the chief scientist for the Nature Conservancy, which is the world's biggest environmental organization. But by all accounts, Kariva's not mired in doomsday rhetoric. In fact, he says environmentalists and activists need to develop a new paradigm for the planet. That kind of thinking and talking and writing has his colleagues either shocked and appalled or nodding vigorously in agreement. Peter Kariva joins me in the studio. It's a pleasure to have you here in your, what somebody called your adopted hometown. I don't know how long it's been since you've been at the University of Washington.
It's been over 10 years, but I've lived here in Seattle now for over 30 years. So this is my hometown.
Are you ever here?
I'm here quite a bit.
You're here quite a bit.
I hide out when I'm here, though.
You and your colleagues have just published a paper about coastal preservation and thinking about how to prevent some of what we have seen in the aftermath of Superstorm Sandy, which, as I understand it, I haven't been there personally, like the entire loss of coastlines. And essentially, it seems like a no-brainer that to protect shoreline areas from devastating storms or other kind of impacts, you kind of preserve the habitat that was there or restore the habitat that was there. Is that the gist of what you're saying?
You know, that is the basic gist. And we've known this, coastal engineers and ecologists have known this for a long time, but we've tended to tell the story after the fact. After Katrina, we say, oh, we lament we lost this habitat, and if only we hadn't. And after Sandy, we lament that we've lost the sand dunes, and if only we hadn't. The purpose of this paper was to really be proactive, to get ahead of the game and say, let's take the whole country, map it 1 kilometer at a time, and say, what are the areas where we can anticipate there being storms? Because we know where there's storms and there's storm surges.
Sure.
Where can we anticipate it? Is there habitat there that could protect lives and property? And if there is, then that provides us a map of, you know, something to do to prevent instead of cry about damage.
So let's talk about Katrina a second. I'm not sure if they're there now or not. There were a delta of wetlands and marshes. And as I understand it, those act as natural drainage areas so that when you block them off with some sort of man-made physical barriers or you drain them to put houses or cottages on, that the sort of percolation of water that might accumulate, that's one problem, that doesn't happen anymore.
Well, in Katrina, there's all sorts of ways we modified the coastline with straight ditches for oil mm-hmm. pipes from the Gulf, with interrupting the sediment flow that builds the marshes, with destroying oyster reefs, when oyster reefs cut down on wave damage, and they also cut down on sediment loss. So it's a whole host of ways we modified it. And that's a good example of
but that one I understand. It's sand dunes that I'm less clear about. So I know that there's been a lot of construction in the Northeast on the dunes, near the dunes, sort of eroding the dunes. But what do dunes do when it comes to protecting areas from damage like we saw from Sandy?
So dunes, when we think about dunes, they're one of many habitat types. So what I'm going to say for dunes also would work for salt marshes. It would work for kelp forests. It'd work for oyster reefs, work for coral reefs, work for seagrass beds, to varying degrees. But all of these things, think about a wave coming in, mm-hmm. a wave surge coming in from the ocean. These natural habitats reduce the amplitude and energy. They dissipate the energy of the wave and then protect what's behind it. And anything you do that cuts it down or degrades it, you lose that protection. And, you know, there's a really good calculation one of our coastal engineers did that I think is pretty dramatic. Imagine a 6-foot wave. We could all think of a 6-foot wave. If you have nothing, so like a parking lot, just a flat seabed, mm-hmm. and you have that 6-foot wave, you need a 16-foot levee to protect you. Now take, if there are 500 meters or so, put in 500 meters of salt marsh. Salt marsh doesn't seem that dramatic. It's not even as high as a sand dune.
No.
There's a salt marsh, and you have that 6-foot wave, and you only need a 4-foot levee.
Wow.
So that's
quite a bit of difference.
That gives you some really concrete view of this natural habitat. It has real protective value.
We're talking with Peter Kariva, who's chief scientist for the Nature Conservancy, and they've just co-authored a report about how to best protect coastal areas from storm damage and all sorts of other things. And I am interested because I wonder how this jibes with something that I read that you said. It was on a website called Energy Wire. And this is a quote: "The reality is that humans degrade and destroy and crucify the natural environment. And 80% of the time it recovers pretty well."
Yeah.
Were you just throwing that quote out?
No, I, there's been a couple of sometimes I wish I hadn't used the word recover. I might have used the word compensated.
Okay.
But there have been a number of studies published where they synthesized all the examples they could find of deforestation, logging, clear cutting, oil spills, pretty dramatic things. And then they looked where people collected data afterwards, and there had been a lot of recovery. It doesn't absolutely look the same, but it also doesn't equate with the image of catastrophe. We've lost it forever. You can go around. I mean, rivers are amazing examples. You can go around the world and see rivers that were so toxic and now have fishing tournaments that are good for swimming in.
So what you're saying is that there's hope. You're an optimist.
Yes.
There seems like there's been a tsunami of people talking about this, but I've seen here and there people looking back into the way past, sort of paleoecologists, archaeologists, historians looking back and saying, well, if you take this macro view, humans have been around for centuries. They've done things to the environment. And it doesn't mean that it dies. It just, we recover. And they're even talking about massive epidemics. We could be wasted and then we look at Mount St. Helens, it recovers. So how does the study of coastal habitat protection jibe with that long-term view?
Well, it very, very much so. I think if we think about restoration with a grander vision, meaning we invest a lot in it. So again, go back to the Gulf Coast. It cost about $1 million a mile to restore an oyster reef. That seems it's really expensive. So maybe we restore 600 miles, $500 million. Seems huge, but we can do it. And if we do it, we've started to do it, the payoffs, you don't see them immediately, but it essentially pays for itself in 10 to 20 years, pays off in terms of jobs. And you can take what is a totally transformed coastline because of our human activities and return it to something pretty natural.
So where do humans fit into all of that when we... I mean, we live here now. You have called the era that we're living in the Anthropocene, the age of man, which makes me think of Lord of the Rings. The age of man is over. The age of orcs has begun.
Right. But
what does that mean? We're never going to – does that mean that we never return pristine nature to pristine nature?
I think everybody knows that. Yeah, we're not going to go back to pristine nature. I think sometimes I wish that we conservation thought of ourselves as futurists instead of going back. And we envisioned a future. We asked ourselves, we love nature. What do we want nature to look like in 50 years?
Well, it's interesting. So you work for the Nature Conservancy, and just by its name, conservation is a preservation mode. It's not necessarily a proactive verb.
It isn't. You're right. I like to think, and I think it's pretty true, the Nature Conservancy is very, very proactive because we do not try to restore things to pristine conditions. We work with ranchers all over the West, and you can, ranch lands can be some of the best sources of wildlife there is.
I've recently been watching on KCTS, our local public television station, the Ken Burns series about the national parks, America's Best Idea. And within the movement for parks themselves, it seems like there's that competing vision of like, we're going to set this land aside or we're going to preserve a place where Americans and other people can go and see a place. Do you know what I'm saying? That we're going to set it aside and make it pretty inaccessible, or we're going to open it as the access to something that doesn't exist in our cities. So, where do you come down?
The U.S. national park system is just one flavor of what around the world is sort of called protected areas, and we've all sort of realized it that protected areas in a really absolute sense, like keep everybody out, by themselves will not do the job for conservation. We need them. We absolutely need them. But you should recognize some of our national parks. I mean, as an example, Shenandoah outside in Virginia is one of the most visited national parks there is. It was initially farmland, and people were moved out of it, and it's all regrown. So even those national parks had some interesting origins. I think we ought to think of national parks as national treasures, and the U.S. public has some say in how they want them used. We probably want wilderness areas. We're areas where you got to backpack in. There's no stands, you know, hot dog stands or campgrounds or anything. You really have to rough it. Those are wonderful. We need some of those. But we also need parks close to cities with real access to people, where people could be introduced to nature. They could take their kids. Maybe they can access the parks with wheelchairs. And so we need a rich portfolio of parks.
We're talking with Peter Kariva, who's chief scientist for the Nature Conservancy. When you were here at the University of Washington, you were here during the spotted owl debates. I believe you testified on behalf of setting aside land for the owl habitat. Was that the right thing to do?
So the spotted owl trials was sort of a life-changing moment for me. I was filled with self-delight because I thought I was an eco-warrior in the image of eco-warriors, you know, stopping development and saving wildlife and old growth. And I believe that was important. But there was a moment in the downtown, in the federal courthouse, Judge mm-hmm. Dwyer ran it. And I looked in the back of the room, and there were loggers, you know, and they would line up also outside the courthouse with their kids on their shoulders. And their children were the same age as my kids were at that time. And they'd have signs around them saying, "You care more about owls than you care about our kids." That was theater. I know that was theater. But at the same time, it struck a chord because of the same age of our children. And ever since then, I've thought that conservation that makes it a battle between people and nature is not the game we want to be in.
Well, that brings me back to the idea of the coast and coastal habitats, because just to go back to Katrina again, is shrimpery the word? The Gulf shrimp fishery?
I guess shrimpery is a good word.
The shrimpery, anyway. There's Gulf shrimp are back in the stores. But it was after Katrina, when the oil well blew and we saw, you know, zillions of gallons of oil going into that Gulf of Mexico, people were really worried. The shrimpers were worried. That's their livelihood. You can't go out and catch shrimp. So when we talk about protecting the area and then we see a devastating spill, is there a way that we balance the jobs, the people who work from the shore, not just in the water, and protect the habitat that's there and restore it to some state of what it used to be like?
So at the Nature Conservancy, we have this sort of buzzword that we call it development by design. And we implement it all around the world. And it's very much that notion. So we would go into an area like the Gulf and say, what does society need? What do we need? Well, we need fisheries. We need coastal recreation. We need to get some energy, too, out of there. We need wildlife. And then you use the best science. It's making maps, and you negotiate in a detailed sort of map-based way the best you can to accommodate all those. And what I think people don't realize, if you get out in front of the game, you can do that. You could sort of have your cake and eat it too. There's parts of the world where it's so crowded and there's so much competing demands, that's probably not the case. But in much of the U.S., certainly, we have the leeway to do that. In Mojave, we do it. There's massive solar energy things. Well, you could find a place for the solar energy and for the desert tortoise.
I understand that not everybody at the Nature Conservancy at first was quite in agreement with the way that you view the work of the organization.
I think that's certainly true, but I blame that on my poor choice of words often. I think people who work for the Nature Conservancy, I mean, they love species. They love nature. They feel a sense of loss when any part of nature is lost. And I think it's possible to listen to what I say and basically say, where's that sense of loss about nature? You're talking about people all the time. And that's not my point. And my point is, what do we want in the future? You and I want the same things. This is my best idea of how to get that future.
Is the conservation movement aging itself out of relevance?
Hey, that's one of those questions. It's dangerous for me to answer. But the conservation movement is changing a lot. And we're making a real effort. I mean, if you look at the conservation movement, it emerged in the Earth Day and the 60s. It was a certain generation. It had a lot of energy. And now a lot of our energy is social energy. You know, my daughter, very interested in social causes. And they still care about the environment, but I think the conservation movement and the environmental movement has to also link up to, you know, social justice, economic development as well. And if it does, it won't age itself out of existence.
Well, you've actually linked it specifically with the women's movement.
Yes.
Is that because you have a daughter, first of all? And second of all, how what's the connection between those two?
Well, you know, there's a number of good studies that show that we call gender and conservation studies that show when women are involved in decision making for resource use, often the resource use is wiser. And it's because, like in Africa and Asia, it's the women that have to go collect firewood for their stoves. It's the women that have to go, you know, do the work, frankly. And involving them in decisions really can make for very good conservation.
A lot of the leaders of the environmental movement in Africa are women.
Right.
What about this idea of sustainable development? Do you have any thoughts on what that word means?
So people, a lot of people, I think, don't like that word because they think it's a little content-free, like it can mean anything.
Are you one of those people?
I was initially one of those people, but then I realized that a lot of people want it. I mean, even if they don't know what it means, they want it. So why don't we give meaning to it? And I think the sustainable development should be that we leave, whatever we do, we leave for the next generation the same opportunities we had entering it. And that means opportunities for nature experience. That means opportunities for economic growth. That means opportunities for education. So sustainable development means from generation to generation, you leave them the same opportunities. You can't guarantee it, but you at least leave them the same opportunities.
So when we go back to this proactive look at the coastline of America, the map is so fascinating because you've got it color-coded about where we can expect the worst storms. Not here on the East Coast, actually. It's pretty red. That's where most of the population lives, too, compared to if you omit, you know, Seattle, LA, and San Francisco. We're still pretty unpopulated as opposed to the East Coast. Look at the research that you've done, the population that's there, and then this idea of leaving something for the next generation. What do you advocate?
So, you know, one thing isn't going to do it, but we advocate massive habitat restoration, massive, what initially seems expensive, but I think is a terrific investment, capital investment of habitat restoration. We advocate giving people incentives to maybe move away from the coast. You can't force people to move out of these floodplains in these coastal areas, but you can give them incentives that allow them to do it. We advocate taking FEMA. FEMA spends $500 million a year on flood risk mitigation. Well, some of that can be spent in this natural habitat.
You said we can't make people do things. In the Netherlands, for example, which, as I understand it, is an entire floodplain, people aren't allowed to build in certain areas. We are much more permissive when it comes to development in this country.
We certainly are more permissive, but maybe that's a good part of our country.
So massive spending by the government, by private entities, who's going to invest the money?
So sometimes the government, but there's value in it for private entities. You know, we've done work with Dow Chemical Company in Texas, and there's economic arguments for them to spend money on restoring hardwood forests that makes sense. So I think increasingly it's a sort of public-private sector partnership that'll do it.
Right now the city of Seattle is about to spend millions of dollars restoring the seawall that's got all these little holes from a certain kind of worm, and it's old. I know that one of the recommendations is to think about other ways than building seawalls, but how do you balance whether you're going to put in some engineered infrastructure or you're going to look at habitat to help you solve your problems?
So I think a part of our challenge, the Nature Conservancy and people that share the ideas expressed in that paper, is to develop the science and the methods so that an engineering firm like CM2H Hill can find it reliable enough that they can do the calculations and figure out what mixed strategy, what green and gray infrastructure can we do. The problem with the natural habitat is, in contrast to engineering, have very, very good data. We don't, in this country, even have good maps for a coastal habitat. We don't have good maps. So they don't have the information in the detail they would need to do that analysis. I wish the country did something like an Earth Genome Project and just gave us good habitat maps.
So in other words, the action that we could take, there's a recommendation that comes out of your paper, but it isn't something that somebody who's running the city of Seattle can act on today.
That's exactly right. They can't, because it also takes that second level of investment in getting the detailed data and information on your eelgrass beds, your marshes, your local habitat. And but that detailed data will be good for many purposes.
The Human Genome Project took a long time. How long would a coastal mapping genome project take?
The Human Genome Project took 13 years.
That's a long time.
Yeah. But just an investment in it. You could invest in it near cities, near big areas. You don't have to start and do the whole, just like they did for the human genome, as a matter of fact.
And hopefully the brain mapping project will take even less time. Peter Kariva is chief scientist for the Nature Conservancy. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Well, thank you for talking with me.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
And now, the sound of the day.
It's kind of multiple sounds. Our listener Chris sent us this recording. It's the sound of his daughter jumping on a trampoline while being sprayed, I assume by Chris, with a garden hose. Who needs a fan or air conditioning? Best way to stay cool on a hot day, jump and be sprayed at the same time. What interesting sounds are you listening to? Record 30 seconds and send that sound to us along with the story behind it. You can email the audio file to weekday@kuow.org and be sure you include sound of the day in the subject line. You can listen to our archive shows at the website, kuow.org. Just search for Weekday, and this show, this hour that you just heard, will be up there a little bit after noon this afternoon. Coming up in the next hour, news from Canada, film, and the world of technology with Todd Bishop here on Weekday.
KUOW 94.9. Film critic Robert Horton reveals his all-time favorite movies this morning at 10:20.
This week, we meet with two artful improvisers. Bela Fleck joins us for a conversation about the banjo in bluegrass, jazz, and classical. Then we'll go for a jazz breakdown with New Orleans percussionist Jason Marsalis, plus music from Jerry Garcia, Patsy Cline, and Slim Gaylock. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.